Lot of information there. Our next speaker is going to be Scott Mercer. Thank you so much. I want to let you know how you didn't say this, but you know, you study these orcas, you observe them, you get to know them. They have personalities, families, they're a matriarchal society. The pods, they don't share DNA, right? I mean, the pods are kind of like these systems that are real families. Yeah. I mean, it's extraordinary. And I can only imagine the heartbreak you must feel as you see the lack of food and witness these whales that you have been observing for decades starving to death. So really appreciate all that information. And we do have orcas here off our coast. And we'll be talking about that too. So, and remember that we do have a panel after our next two speakers, so you can ask more questions then. Okay, really excited about our next presenter, Scott Mercer. He's the co-founder with Tree Mercer of the Metanoma Whale and Seal Study right down here in Wallala. And we're so lucky to have somebody who has been researching marine mammals since 1974. Long, long time, decades, where he has been studying the behavior of marine mammals in our oceans. It goes on and on and on. He's got quite the bio. I don't know what else to say, Scott. If you want to say anything else, I've got a long bio here, but I think you should just come on up and continue with that introduction. Watch your step. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Nobody wants to follow Howie in a talk. Howard Garrett and I go back to, we figured out the other day, it was 1983. He and I were on the roof of a boat in Massachusetts Bay, right in the shipping lanes, going into Boston Harbor. And we were watching a mother with her 5-month-old calf. And since we're in the middle of the shipping lanes, right away, a very large tugboat came along, towing an even larger barge. And we're both standing there holding our breath as at first the tug went over the mother and calf. They dove upon hearing the ship coming. And then the long cable, and then the even longer barge went over them. And then as soon as the barge was over them, they both popped up. And I don't know what was louder, the mother and calf breathing or Howard and I breathing. We saw them come up. It was amazing, though, that the mother knew exactly when that barge was over her head. Last night, right at the time the siren went off, if you were here last night, that film that Michael Stalker introduced, Sonic Sea, had just reached a point where thank you. Okay, we have our own roadies. It just reached a point where it was showing an important point in the researching of noise and right whales, North Atlantic right whales, took place. I'd just like to tell you what you missed if you were here. Rosalind Russell, who is Scott Krause's wife, and Rosalind Russell is a, I mentioned Krause for a reason, his name's going to come up again. Rosalind Russell is a marine mammal veterinarian at the New England Aquarium, and she and the entire New England right whale team from the aquarium, New England Aquarium right whale team, go into the Bay of Fundy, or have been going into the Bay of Fundy for many years to study right whales in the summering grounds. And you saw Howie's black dog there on the slide. They use a fecal-smelling dog, as Howard showed in his slide, to locate right whale poop. And there's great importance to gathering the poop. You can tell what the whale's eaten, and also measure the amount of glucocorticoids in their, or stress hormones in their body that they're expelling out with the waste. Well, they did that every day, collecting this, whenever they could find the whale's fecal material floating, and it's easier than you think, because when they go, it covers an area the size of this floor, if not bigger. And but the dogs are very good at smelling it. Well, they collected every day, and they had very high levels of stress hormones in the whales. And they were attributing that to the noise in the ocean, which, you know, is cutting out their sounds. And many of the whales have even raised their voices higher to try to get above the background noise caused by shipping. Well, along came, this was back in September of 2011. September 9th occurred, and George Bush shut down all of the shipping and airplane travel in the country. And the aquarium kept going out doing their baseline data every day. And they were collecting fecal material. And when they analyzed it, all during that time where Bush had shut down the shipping and the airline traffic, the amount of stress hormones dropped considerably when that background noise was stopped. And then when they started the shipping and the airline traffic again, the hormone levels were right back up again, stress hormones. So it was a good indication, and it was a type of experiment that really can't be replicated again under those conditions, have that kind of quiet take place. Okay, I go back quite a ways with right whales. I saw my first right whales in 1978. Scott Krause and I were out on a boat out of Seabrook, New Hampshire. It was actually the first whale and seabird trip that I ever led. And I hired Krause to help me out with this because he had more experience than I did. And the first two whales we ran into were North Atlantic right whales. What we didn't know at the time is that they were both pregnant. And because they showed up in Georgia back in the wintertime in February with calves. Now, it wasn't unknown that that's the place that they have their calving, but it was a good indication, and there was a background of that had been done by other people. Okay, what's happening with right whales is there are about 411 of these right whales left, and only 7 calves were born in 2019. There were none born in 2018. We were hoping for 7 calves this past year, and we got 7. But unfortunately, 9 whales have died since then. The 9th one was found in September floating off of Long Island, New York. So we got 7 and lost 9, so a net loss of 2. In the last 21 years, in the last 2 years, 21 right whales were found dead, including several females. And the effect of these current and future losses, this tiny population is devastating. There are about 100 females left. And at the rate that the females are being killed in entanglements and ship strikes, there couldn't be enough females not left in the population within 20 years that they won't be able to recover. So they could be extinct because of a loss of reproductive females. Okay, their range. Scott Krause and I went down to the southeast coast of the United States in 1984 to start doing systematic surveys of the area off of Georgia and Florida. And we found that we did find mothers with, and this is in the middle of winter, in February and March, we did find mothers with newborn calves. Now the, I got it. right, the pregnant females come down here to have their calves. And then in March, they begin working their way up the coast here. In other right whales from parts unknown in the North Atlantic, we don't know where the rest of the right whale population spends its winter time, but they come in into the Great South Channel, and they're joined by the mothers with their calves up in here, and they begin feeding very heavily on copepods, very small zooplankton that feeds in turn heavily on diatoms and other plant plankton. Yeah, this is the Great South Channel is just south of Cape Cod, down in this area. It's not quite where that blob is. It's kind of down in here, near Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard. That's Long Island, New York there. So it's kind of in here. After they feed heavily in the Great South Channel, they move up into Cape Cod Bay, and you can find sometimes 80 right whales right in Cape Cod Bay feeding on copepods. And then they move up the coast of New Hampshire and Maine up into the Bay of Fundy, or have been historically. And that's where Roz Russell did her work with the fecal material. But in recent years, in the last 6 or 7 years, the right whales haven't been going in here. And the reason is the water's warmed up so much and the copepod production dropped off so badly that they can't find enough to eat. So they showed up in the Gulf of St. Lawrence up here, and immediately 18 right whales were killed up in here by ship strikes and entanglements. The Canadian government under Trudeau did a good job of immediately ordering the ships to be slowed down coming into the St. Lawrence Channel, which helped quite a bit, and also shut down part of the crab industry in this area to reduce some of the entanglements. Okay, this is a copepod right here, and this is what right whales feed on. Now, we knew a long time ago that if something happened to the environment, or there was a lack of copepods, since they feed almost primarily on copepods, unlike other large whales that feed on a variety of prey items, that if they lost this food source, they'd be in a lot of trouble. Well, that's why they moved out of the Bay of Fundy, and they actually began moving into the Gulf of St. Lawrence, as I said, to find colder water and more copepods. Now, it's unlikely that the right whales got together and said, let's go try the Gulf of St. Lawrence. It may have been in their cultural memory that they knew to try up there, or they may have just been following colder water, colder and colder as they went, and got up into Canadian waters. But these copepods feed voraciously on plant plankton, and plant plankton has a little glob of oil in it to keep it afloat, to allow it to photosynthesize. And when they do, they fill up with, become a good source of omega-3. Of omega-3, so at lunchtime, if you want to get on the headlands and jump in and do some filter feeding, it may be beneficial to your heart to load up on these. Calanus glacialis is one species they like. Finmarchicus is the one they really prefer, Calanus finmarchicus. But they will also feed on Pseudocalanus. Pseudocalanus elongata is one that they're not above feeding on if these aren't available. But this whole body thing here, body capsule, fills up with oil and becomes a rich food source for them. If you eat a ton a day, and how many of you will admit to watching SpongeBob SquarePants? All right, good, because the story behind that show is that some guys from Humboldt who were majoring in marine biology came up with that show because they saw so many funny things under microscopes so they just couldn't help themselves. But copepod is that little wisecracking green guy with the one dot on his head. That's a copepod, which is what you have here. There's the antennae and the red eye spot right there. Okay. And this is a right whale feeding. You photo-identify right whales by photographing these thickened skin growths called callosities up on the top of their head. They're in a different place on each right whale. And right in here, these are the baleen plates hanging down. And these hang down so they kind of overlap. And it's made out of keratin, like your fingernails and toenails, and your hair. And on the inside of the baleen is very hairy looking. But you'll notice here that there's an opening in the front. Most baleen whales have this shut tight with more baleen, so the fish they feed on doesn't escape as they lunge at it. But these guys just move along slowly, moving their tails, and as they do, the water flows in. They move their tongues up and down inside their mouth, forcing the water out through the baleen plates. And when they feel that the inside here is gummed up with those little copepods, then they close their mouth, they'll shake their head up and down, rattle their head back side by side. You hear the rattling of the baleen sometimes when they do that. And the water that's inside their mouth helps to slosh down the copepods, and then they swallow and start again. Now, exactly how they find the amount of copepods they want to feed on, we don't really know. Through plankton toes have been done by the Center for Coastal Studies in Provincetown. They'll follow right whales around very slowly and do plankton toes in the areas where they stop, so they get an idea of the density. But right whales will search around like a housefly on a corner until they find the density they want, and they open their mouth and they begin feeding. And this is what an entanglement looks like. It's another Scott. This is Scott Landry. There are a lot of Scots on the East Coast photographing whales. This is Scott Landry. This whale was entangled in the Gulf of St. Lawrence and swam 600 miles with 300 feet of rope around its mouth and through its mouth and around its body. It was wrapped up so bad it couldn't move its right flipper. It still swam 600 miles to get down off the coast of Provincetown. And I'm not saying it knew that the best rescue team in the world was there, but they came out and rescued it. These guys risk their lives every single day. You can see the helmets. They wear some body padding. And these are tools that they themselves invented for freeing the whales. It's all through trial and error. They got this whale free eventually. But this is the baleen right here that you saw hanging down. This is the way it's supposed to look. It's not supposed to be sticking out of the front of their mouth like you see here. This whale, we hope, is going to live. It was emaciated when it got down into the waters off of Massachusetts, where Scott and his team came out and freed it.
Did it survive?
We hope so. It was still alive as of a month ago, last I heard about it. That ropes like that can amputate limbs. There was one whale that had the rope go up into its brain case. Now, the big issue that's going on in Maine right now, Maine lobster, there was a move on to get the vertical lines in Maine reduced by 50%. That was opposed by the lobster industry. And the idea was to bring in ropeless gear. As Scott Landry says, if there's a vertical line, there's eventually going to be an entanglement. So the idea was to reduce the vertical lines by 50%. Since lobstering in Maine is basically a religion, and it's been fished, they've been taken the same way for hundreds of years, there's a lot of resistance to this. And at first, the Maine Lobstermen's Association endorsed the idea, but they just recently pulled their endorsement of it. And unfortunately, both U.S. Senators, Susan Collins, I usually get a chorus of boos when I mention her name. That's better. And Angus King, both have opposed the regulations to reduce the number of vertical lines and also to start bringing in the ropeless gear. So for now, they still get entangled and ship struck. Unfortunately, one of the arguments that the lobstermen are presenting is that the right whales aren't showing up in Maine waters anymore because of climate change and the water warming up. They're moving up into Canada. Well, what they're not thinking is eventually climate change is going to impact their business, so they're going to lose their lobsters either way. So sometimes they're slow to come to food chain conclusions. Okay, the Gulf of Maine warming up, as you can see here. The Gulf of Maine actually is warming up faster than any other body of water, ocean body of water on the globe. And the temperature is reaching 70 degrees now in the Gulf. Now, this is northern New England and Canada we're talking about, not the coast of Florida and Georgia. 70 degree water showing up in these areas. And what sets off a domino effect where water that warms up expands. So you get higher high tides with a little more force behind them. And it goes up into the estuaries much further. It's warm water invading up into the estuaries. And it devastated the main softshell clam industry, which is second only to lobster in seafood take. And also, as it went up into the estuaries, it badly damaged the salt marsh areas as well. So you have an effect there with less, as the water warms up, you have less phytoplankton or plant plankton, which is less food for the zooplankton. And I should mention before I forget that the phytoplankton in the world's oceans remove 100 million tons of carbon every day. So not only do those little phytoplankton give us a lot of oxygen, those little green cells, they only give us a tremendous amount of oxygen. They also remove 100 million tons of carbon every day. It's a little time lapse of how the Gulf is warming up. Okay, now moving on to gray whales. That wasn't depressing enough. The gray whale unusual mortality event, or UME, as you call it, since January 2019, there's been elevated gray whale strandings that have occurred along the west coast of North America from Mexico through Alaska. This event was declared a UME by NOAA on May 31, 2019. The most recent abundance estimate from NOAA is nearly 27,000 whales in a 2015-16 survey. That seems like a lot of whales. We were saying 20,000, and suddenly we were saying 27,000, but I was never very good in math and statistics, so I'll take their word for it. That work was actually done down in Granite Canyon over five seasons to come up with that high number. Okay, this is a combined 2019 gray whale strandings in California, Oregon, Washington, and Alaska compared to 99,000 UME. So at this angle, let's see, the light blue was 99. The dark blue was 2000, and we're 2019. Now this, the really high one here was associated with a bad El Nino out here. Now this is an average of, from an 18-year average, the black, and this is just this year, 2019. I forget to say something. I'm used to Tria pushing the button here for me, so I got too much to think about. Okay, the gray whale strandings by state, Alaska, Washington, Oregon. You can see where California had the high, and Washington did it. As the whales move up into Alaska, this number was going up, up, up very quickly in the spring. And then the country here, U.S. leads. Oh, down in Mexico, there were quite a few, as I think Michael's mentioned last night, Michael Stalker, that first that was noticed down there were skinny calves, skinny mothers, and just skinny whales in the area. There's a juvenile that came ashore on Lemon Tower, down in Point Reyes. One of the many dead ones. Now, one thing that I need to mention here is, I'll even go back, maybe. The number of dead whales was 209? 212, right? And so with only about, I watch my thumb. For every whale that we know is dead, we estimate there were 10 we didn't know about. That's because gray whales, unlike right whales, tend to sink when they're dead. And also, there's many nooks and crannies on this coast. You can lose whales. Just imagine how we could wash into the Lost Coast with nobody around there. So we think there are over 2,000, maybe getting close to 2,100 dead gray whales. And this is the, most of you know this, but this is the path of the gray whale migration up through Unimak Pass, where your next speaker has spent a lot of time in this area, the Aleutians, up into the Chukchi Sea, the Bering Sea, and the Beaufort Sea. Yeah, most of the mothers and calves that we see coming by are very close to shore off of Point Reyes, a point arena where we sit, sometimes almost skimming the rocks as they go by. They are close to shore as opposed to being out here, but they're still a couple of miles out. Most of the gray whales that we see northbound are still quite a ways offshore, but not that far offshore. Well, the question was, why are they so close to shore? And the traditional answer was that they're trying to stay away from orcas, since orcas, the transient orcas will attack the mothers, especially the mothers and calves, but in Monterey Bay, the calves are kind of free game down there for the transients. They move into that area knowing that the mothers and calves are coming by. But we do see, we're out every day during the census, and we do see that many of the northbound whales are a couple of miles offshore. So mothers and calves that skim right in close. Okay, that showed the warming up of the waters in Alaska. All right, this is the ice algae. The The ice algae grows on the bottom of the ice, as you can see here. And this is probably a melt hole right here where light's getting through. The the ice down there is 2.8 million years, has been in existence 2.8 million years, nearly 3 million years. So the ice is the ecosystem in the Arctic. Everything is timed around the ice. And some recent work down there has shown that even though the ice in April, there's very little sunlight, the ice is where it is at its thickest, and sometimes there's a foot of snow on top of some of it. And the ice still only needs 0.02% of the sunlight to photosynthesize. So it can, if it was up on top, it would have 100% of the available sunlight. But down below like that, it can still work with only 0.02%. Now, there are thousands of animals, invertebrates and small fish, that will come up and feed on this ice, on the algae. And it's a good early food source when the daylight increases or begins to increase. And the animals come up to feed, which would be planktonic animals and also small fish. And here's a photograph of a melt pond on Arctic sea ice and some of the plumes of algae that's down there. In June, when there's more open water, even more all the time now, more open water, there is. That's when the diatoms in the plant plankton begins to bloom very heavily. So first you have the ice algae as a food source, and then the animals rely on the increased amount of plant plankton and the increased amount of invertebrates like copepods feeding on that, which supports feeding by fish. And it affects every trophic level from copepods and other zooplankton right up to polar bears, walruses, and seals, and eventually whales feeding in the area. This is what phytoplankton looks like, various cells of it. And some of these are copepods, and some of this is krill in here. Two Arctic amphipods. Now, the gray whales that we have feed on amphipods primarily, not entirely, but mostly on amphipods. And as the ice algae will eventually, some of it falls off and drifts down. It's fed on by organisms on the way down the water column. When it gets down to the bottom, it's fed on by the amphipods that the gray whales feed on. If you haven't seen gray whales, or you probably haven't seen them since they do it underwater, but when gray whales are feeding, they make pits in the ocean. They roll, open their mouth. They have very thick baleen. On the right whale baleen you saw was 5 or 6 feet long in some cases. We have a couple pieces at home that are like 3 feet, 4 feet long. And it's very flat, very flimsy and fragile. On a gray whale, it's short and stocky because they come in on the bottom and they open their mouth and they roll. And that's to dislodge amphipods from the bottom, and they make these big pits in the bottom of the ocean, which are very helpful to the ecology of the bottom of the ocean because they're overturning the bottom and aerating it. And then they'll take a mouthful of amphipods and force the water out through the thick baleen plates and then swallow the amphipods. Well, they also try to emit the sand at the same time and then swallow the amphipods that they've caught. Okay, where the fecal-smelling dogs come in, this is a whale that's pooping. And Howard's slide there showed a black lab. All of the best fecal-smelling dogs I've encountered are all black labs. So, if you have a black lab at home that's just laying around the house, seems to have no direction in life, you might try steering it toward fecal-smelling, whale fecal-smelling, because it seems to be a growing field there. Because these whales poop, as I said, the area fills up is about the size of this floor right here easily. And I've had the pleasure of seeing it thousands of times when you're out on feeding grounds. And it fertilizes the top layers of the ocean. So people ask, well, what good are whales? What matters it make to me if the whales die or they go extinct? And not only would the world be incredibly boring, as Roger Payne once said, insufferably boring, but if we only had ourselves to look at. But unless you're Donald Trump, then I guess you like looking at yourself. But one thing they do to benefit us and help climate change is by pooping so much. And when there were more whales, you can imagine there was 10 or 20 times more poop in the ocean. And that fertilizes the top layers of the ocean and makes a natural fertilizer very high in nitrogen and iron to fertilize the plant plankton, which causes tremendous blooms, which grab carbon out of the air and give us back oxygen. The only person I know who ever got that wrong was Ronald Reagan. And there's his famous speech about trees cause air pollution. That was right, I think it was in the same speech as One Redwood, you've seen them all. he actually said that. He had it backwards. He thought they took in oxygen and gave off carbon. So we have an animated cartoon here, not this one, but the whale emits a large brown cloud that the black labs find, and then it's fed on by phytoplankton. I'm not sure what they're doing in there, but phytoplankton, which is fed on by zooplankton and eventually whales.